Hi, good afternoon. I've condensed my usual 15-minute introduction to about three, so I hope that's okay. Seriously, it's really an honor and a pleasure to introduce our speaker today. This is an outstanding lady, an American hero in many ways. Her accomplishments are many and varied, many accomplishments. I know a lot of you will remember a moonwalk a number of years ago. Well, Susan grew up in Portland, Oregon with two sisters, and Mom got Susan up to watch the moonwalk, and I think that way there was not an astronaut program, but that kind of destined her future as maybe being an astronaut. I like to think of it that way. Some of you may remember it was in the mid-1970s where Congress decreed that the military academies should begin to take women, all of them, and Susan was a benefit of that. She immediately got busy on application, and normally it takes at least 2 years, and they were such in a hurry to admit women, it only took a year for her to be accepted with the first class of women. In that class, 1,600 people, male and female, of which 899 got commissioned. There were 157 women, of which 97 were commissioned after 4 years. So her date of graduation, commission date, is 1980. I want to fast forward now up to when she was a major, and seemed like time to maybe try to go into the astronaut program, and she was accepted. Went in 1990, came out in a couple years later as an astronaut. A couple things were in her bio that you've seen, but I want to repeat. This lady did five different missions as an astronaut. She was in space a total of 211 days. You know, I can figure that out pretty quick. That's more than 6 months. That's more than a half a year. And next, she still holds the world record for the longest walk in space of 8 hours and 56 minutes, which is quite an account. Okay. She returned to the Air Force as a lieutenant colonel. And during her 4 years in and out of Russia, she was on a Russian base when she was given her promotion to bird colonel. And the Russians had a party for her. I don't know how much vodka flowed that night. She didn't tell me. But I don't remember the word. I couldn't pronounce a Russian word. But they referred to now as a real colonel. And she was the highest-ranking woman on that base in Russia at that time, which was another first for a lady, which was great. Let's see. I'm gonna just go on real quick to some personal items because I think that's kind of more fun, a couple things she's been involved in. 2001 Academy Awards, Steve Martin. They opened that ceremony from the space, up in space, and she was a spokesperson for that group at those awards. Moving right along, as you may know or remember, she has flown in or flown more than 30 types of U.S. and Canadian aircraft. And today, her best airplane is the one she likes to fly, which is a Cessna 172. I don't think we have a piano in here. Otherwise, we might ask her to play. She is a jazz pianist. And when the astronaut band was formed, why, she became the pianist for the astronaut band. Let's see. I'm almost to the end here. The big thing I like is I asked Susan, I said, your parents must be very, very proud of you. And she said, well, my father, a Vietnam helicopter pilot, has no buttons on most of his shirts, so I think that answers your question. Okay. Anyway, let me get on with it here, because, again, here's a lady that has done so many things in her career for all of us so that we could do some things that we do, and I think that's very key to all of it. So I'd ask you to give a very warm Forum Club welcome to Lieutenant General Susan Helms, our speaker.
Thank you so much, Dave, and of course, thank you to the Forum Club for inviting me to speak today and tell you a little bit about my experiences in space. I think that's the topic I enjoy talking about the most, and that's the topic apparently that's been requested, and I've got a lot to say about how great that was. But I also want to thank the four young ladies who came up here and talked to us about their dreams and goals. I know that takes a lot of guts to stand up in front of a group like this and express yourself. And all four of you are my heroes because you are doing what is hard, not what is easy. And I wish all four of you the very best of luck, and I hope there's a lot more behind you that we didn't see today that are doing the same thing. Thank you, ladies, for being so inspirational. Okay, oftentimes that long-duration spacewalk comes up where it's mentioned that I, as well as my spacewalking partner, Jim Voss, hold the world record for the longest spacewalk, and all I can tell you about that is that it was too short. 211 days in space. It was too short. My space flights, four of them were on the space shuttle, which means that they were relatively short. The duration of those space missions ran from 1 to 3 weeks. And then my last space flight, which was conducted in 2001, which is kind of cool that you fly in space in 2001, for those of you who are Stanley Kubrick fans. That's the one where we actually opened up the Academy Awards from space. And the Oscars, they wanted to have a 2001 Space Odyssey theme that year, and we happened to be the crew that was in orbit to do the recording for that opening. The other thing I'd like to mention about that particular flight was, unlike the other four flights that I had already flown, that particular flight was an expedition living on the International Space Station. So that shuttle mission was a one-way trip for me and my two crewmates, Jim Voss and Yuri Usachov. For those of you who aren't aware, the International Space Station, which is our international space outpost in orbit right now, is a multinational affair to include the Russians, which for an Air Force colonel who was raised in the Cold War era, learning about the Soviet Union as our adversaries, to then come upon this grand adventure to live on a space outpost with Russian nationals in addition to Americans, Canadians, Europeans, Japanese, and other countries, it expanded my mind about humanity to a whole different level. I learned a lot of lessons about these opportunities to fly in space, and today what I'd like to do is share with you some of the things I've learned. I think it's a pretty fascinating discussion to reflect back on having these experiences and realizing that no amount of training and preparation can get you ready for some of the things that you pick up along the way and the things that you keep in your kit bag about life as you close that part of your experience. So the first thing I would like to pass on that I learned is the obvious. Space is a wondrous place. There are so many life-changing impressions that happen in that very first moment after the launch is complete, the engines cut off, you become free-floating because of the lack of apparent gravity, and what is it an astronaut wants to do the instant they get to space? They want to look out the window and look back at Earth. It is an amazing sight. You might think the Earth is blue and green because of how it's characterized by the media at times. It's not. It's blue and white. More than 70% of the Earth is covered with water. And, of course, all of the Earth is covered with weather, clouds. And today, if the astronauts were looking down on Naples, Florida, they wouldn't see it. They'd be seeing clouds, for obvious reasons, if you look out the window. So blue and white. And then the second thing that you realize is that all of humanity on Earth is sustained by a very, very thin layer of air that covers the Earth, not like a donut, which some people have sometimes visualized because of the drawings you see of the Van Allen belt, but it's more like the skin of an apple. The Earth is a very, very fragile place, in part because it seems from the perspective of an astronaut, the covering around the Earth that keeps all of us alive, the air, is a very, very thin skin, like the skin of an apple. Really an interesting impression that you can talk about it, but until you see it with your own two eyes, it really doesn't sink in, the fragility of it all. You don't see a world with borders. You can't tell the difference between Canada and the United States and Mexico. You can't really see all those countries and the lines of demarcation that people are so territorial about. None of that is to be seen from space. And a big surprise for me on my very first mission, asteroids. We flew during one of the meteor showers. And I know that you probably had this impression that you have to look up in space to see the meteors. Not when you're in space. You look down on Earth to see the meteors. Because meteors are visible only when they re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. So when they become their little fireballs, it's very disconcerting. Because you're in a spacecraft flying around the Earth, and the meteors are seen between you and the Earth's surface. I should have known that scientifically before I launched, but it was a surprise nonetheless. You can see the mark of humans on Earth. That some of the things that are more obvious are airports, believe it or not, because of the altitude that we fly our spacecraft. The runway systems of airports are very visible. You know, they're very pale concrete, and they stand out against the background of grass and dirt and cities. The great cities often look gray from space. But the runways and the arrangement of runways of airports often can be used as a determination of figuring out where you are. You can look down and go, well, that's Atlanta, because that airport runway system looks like this, and I know that because I'm a pilot and I've had experience flying around the different airports and I've studied the airport systems. So it's very interesting how runways end up standing out as a marker of making note of where you are around the world. Highway structures. American highway structures are very well organized, very linear, lots of square kind of arrangements in our highway system. Go to Europe, you don't see that at all. You go to India or China, you don't see that at all. Humanity is much more free-flowing and less logical in different places of the world. And the United States just happens to be notable in how we've built our highway systems that can be seen, marked out on the territory. Night lights. I did not realize how many human beings lived on the planet until we flew over parts of the Earth when the Earth was in darkness. And I always knew there were a lot of people in India, China, and Japan. But when you look down on those countries and you see a comparison of the city lights of those areas compared to the United States, we have a lot of land here that is still a wide open frontier. And in other places of the world, by looking down on the city lights, the concentration of humanity is at a whole different level than what we experience here in North America. It was quite a shock to see that for the first time. Again, I'm telling you things that you all already probably understood as facts, but when you see it with your own two eyes from space, it makes all the difference in the world. And so speaking of humanity, the next lesson that I took away from this entire experience is the incredible degree to which space unifies and advantages humanity. You could see this unifying effect when we astronauts would go to Star City and train with the cosmonauts. And again, I'm talking about just a few short years earlier, we were adversaries from the military perspective, and an American colonel going over to places in Star City and sharing training experiences with Russian colonels. And then to meet them face-to-face and understand that really, at our most basic level, we're all humans. And as astronauts and cosmonauts, we're all operators. And we have a lot more in common with them than we thought. There was something about training for space together that brought a unifying aspect to what it was we were trying to do together as a mission. And we got to know the Russians in training. I would have to tell you, my commander of the space station mission, Yuri Usachev, is still one of the best leaders I've ever worked for. And I know that's going to be quite a shock to many of you who work for commanders in the military. Hard to believe that a Russian could be, you know, a really, really good leader. But Yuri Usachev is one of the best. He understood people, he understood space, and he understood operations. And he made our crew experience very positive over those 6 months, which is really important when you're talking about 6 months. Space is also a cultural engine of inspiration for the next generation. There's something about the fact that nations pull together to advance their exploration in space that ends up driving an engine behind the scenes in education, science, and technology that inspire the young people of today to become the leaders of nations for tomorrow. And when you're an astronaut and you get a chance to go out there and be a part of that inspiration machine, you really do get a sense that our future is in really good hands. Because there's something about space that ends up driving people to better themselves and be a part of something greater than themselves for the good of space exploration. Space is also a technological engine for advancing sciences and knowledge of exploration. That's a statement of the obvious. I would tell you that there's a multi-generational thing happening here. The early years with the Gemini and Apollo program, we sent humans into space trying to get a sense of what space was as the great unknown and whether humans could exist in it. The space shuttle program took us to a level where we began to operate in space on a fairly regular basis, albeit short-term missions. But humans not only just existed, they also began to accomplish things like deploying satellites and running basic research in the space environment. The space station is the next stage. It's our space outpost. It's an international outpost, but it is, in fact, an amazing laboratory for us to understand how to advance exploration to a much greater degree than the space shuttle was capable of. And today, having the opportunity to live on space station and live on a space outpost, that's the first time during those, when I was up there for those 6 months, that's the first time I felt like Earth was a different place than where I was, which was a phenomenal psychological experience. And of course, if you think about the next obvious step from here, we're talking about exploration of other places like Mars and an asteroid and the moon. All of it is worth doing. And as we prepare to expand to go to that next stage, you can see this really has been a multi-generational master plan of humans having already explored the Earth that we are sitting on today. It's in our destiny to continue exploration and take it beyond the boundaries of Earth. And we're doing that in a very large strategic, systematic basis. And it's all of humanity. It's not just Americans. The next topic of things that I learned, I just find too irresistible not to talk about. With all of this amazing technology, the building of the space shuttle, the space station being the technological marvel that it is, there is still one thing, I think, that is even more amazing, and that is the human body. When you take the human body to space and it experiences a different environment than the gravity field, you really do realize how amazing we are as machines. There's a lot of things that happen to you when you go to the space environment. The first thing that happens, and it's immediate after the engines cut off on a launch, is that you get a sense of free falling. Now, I know there's probably a lot of people in this room who have had a chance to ride a roller coaster. And when you're at the top of that largest hill on the roller coaster, and you go over the edge, and you have that sense of free falling, that is the sensation that you get after the engine's cut off and you find that you're weightless. The difference is, it never stops. And the amazing thing is, after about a half hour, you don't even notice it. The human body, your brain adapts to that sense of free falling, And yes, you notice that you're now floating everywhere, but the point is, I don't think anyone in this room can imagine not noticing when you're in that roller coaster free fall. And but it's something happens to you when you're in space and the body begins its adaptation. And things like that change. Your perspective changes just by living in a different environment. I like mentioning this little fun fact. When you go to space and you end up living in an environment that doesn't appear to have gravity, your spine is no longer under compression. And so the cartilage between the vertebrae begin to expand because it's not compressed anymore from gravity. And as your muscles will allow, your spine begins to get longer. And so a fun thing astronauts like to do when they get to space, after a couple of days, when the muscles have stretched a little bit, is they like to measure their height. And almost all of us, I think, I certainly know the ones I've flown with, grow 1 to 2 inches taller. The body adapting to that. Now, if you were to take someone and put them on a rack and stretch them 1 to 2 inches taller today, here you'd kill them. But in space, after a couple of days and the muscles stretching to accommodate that spine growth, you don't even feel that anymore. You're just a little bit taller. And that the really fun fact about that kind of stays with you a couple of days after you come home. So before I launch in space every time, I'm 1 inch shorter than my mother. And when I come back at the landing and give her a hug and a kiss, I'm 1 inch taller than my mother. And that is a very surreal experience for her and me. The muscles also shrink in space. The bones become a little bit weaker, but I don't think of these as detriments. I think of these as the human body realizing it doesn't need as much muscle and the bones don't need to be as strong because they don't have to lift the loads and work against gravity in space like they do on Earth. And so the human body is adapting to that naturally. While I was on the space station for 6 months, almost 6 months, I'll tell you, I lost about 20 pounds. I was ecstatic. That's a great thing for me, is to lose 20 pounds. And then when I came back from space, I was very perturbed to hear that I had only lost 7 pounds of fat, and I'd lost 14, 13 pounds of muscle. And the reason I'd lost that muscle was because the body had adapted to living in a weightless environment and not needing as much muscle because you don't have to lift heavy objects and you don't have to worry about the loads of gravity. So the body just adapted to that. And of course, you know what that means. When I came home, the muscle grew back. And so back came those 14 pounds, and I do believe those other 7 pounds of fat came back with it too. It is amazing how the human body recognizes that it needs to be a little bit more efficient in a little bit different way. And it just changes over time. And over those 6 months, we saw those changes. Another thing I didn't realize from my shorter shuttle missions was that the skin of your body will turn over completely in about 4 months. So while we're in space during those 6 months, we can see the shedding of our skin in the filters, the air filters that we had to clean on a weekly basis. We could see skin flakes. The dirtiest things on the space station were the human beings, because our skin was naturally shedding. It sheds here. You don't normally notice it, but it does happen. And in 4 months, the real marker of how much things had changed in our skin was to look down at your feet, and they were like the feet of a baby, because you were not using your feet when you float in space. So this is a story for the ladies. I come back from this long space flight. Time to get a pedicure, right? And so I go to the salon at the Broadmoor, and it's probably about 2 months after the landing. And I said, I'm in dire need of a pedicure. Haven't had one for many months. I'm not going to tell you why, but I need. And when I put my feet up and she looked at him, she goes, "What have you been doing?" She goes, "These are the most amazing feet. You know, what's your secret?" So ladies, you know what I'm taught, you can see this scene, right? And I said, well, you know, I just take good care of my feet. I didn't dare tell her that I had been off the planet in space. So somewhere there is a pedicurist, she might still be at the Broadmoor, who thinks I've got the world's best secret on how to take care of your feet. And I just didn't come out with it. I didn't come out and say, well, I've been off flying in space for 6 months, and that's why my feet are so soft. So, and again, this is yet another thing that is completely reversible. You start using your feet again, they go back to normal. But it was kind of a fun pedicure. The point is, the more we study space, and the more we do space exploration, the more we learn about ourselves. We learn about what we're capable of, we learn about what happens to us, and we learn about the possibilities and potentials. It does take a village to build an astronaut, and so I must spend at least a few minutes talking about the fact that astronauts don't do this on their own. We are the face of success, but we obviously don't accomplish all these amazing achievements just by ourselves. Behind the scenes, there are thousands and thousands of hardworking, yet often faceless, yet extremely smart people who make these missions happen. There are mission control operators, there are rocket builders, there are computer experts, life support savants, and so on and so forth. And so many of these thousands of people aren't even NASA employees. There are contractors in the industrial base that make this happen. And I dare say some of you probably know some of these incredibly amazing people that all come together to achieve these kinds of experiences. And the astronauts are just the teeny tiny little face of it. And so I give immense credit to all the people behind the scenes, the village, town, city, nation, if you will, that pulls all this together. And I am just amazingly lucky to be the one person who got to take advantage of it and take that trip to space on everybody's behalf. Much to my delight, the industrial base is undergoing a renaissance right now. NASA and the administration made a choice to turn over some of this technological capability to the industrial base on the commercial side, and so we now have upstart companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, Orbital is in that business. And it's amazing to see the things they're accomplishing. I had a chance to go to watch a SpaceX team recover a capsule from space. And this is a completely private enterprise, not a NASA enterprise. And when I stood in that room and watched it happen, hardly anybody in that room was over the age of 30. And the look on the faces of those young people who were making this happen, this return of a brand new private enterprise capsule from space, it's called the Dragon, to see what was happening with their faces and to know that they knew what they had achieved, it reminded me of what we probably saw in the faces of NASA people back in the 60s when they achieved the Gemini and Apollo program. There's a whole new generation of young people that are being inspired today by this burgeoning commercial industry that is going through a process of not just supporting NASA and their plans to go explore beyond Earth, but they're also developing a space enterprise on the commercial side for tourism and entertainment. This is part of the plan. And so I like to look at people the age of these young ladies and say, this is going to happen in your lifetime. You're going to get a chance to go to space. All you have to do is probably save your pennies. But these commercial industries are the real deal. They are really pulling it together. And if your children aren't going to fly in space as a matter of just standard business, your grandchildren certainly are. Because the technology is there, the business case is starting to grow, the interest is obviously there, and there's going to be a whole lot more going on in space than just exploration to another planet. And so I think this is just incredibly exciting times. And from my perspective, the more people that go to space and look back at Earth, the better. Because there is something about getting that eyes-on visual strategic perspective that cannot be replicated by words and media. To see it for yourself makes all the difference in the world. one more lesson. And it's related not to my experiences at NASA, but to my return when I came back and entered the Air Force again proper. I was in the Air Force the entire time I was at NASA. I continued my career from the Air Force's perspective. I was just stationed in Houston from their view. I kept getting paid by them. And when I came back, I had the opportunity to go to Space Command. I eventually became a vice commander and then the commander here in Florida, Patrick Air Force Base, Cape Canaveral, was the command that they gave me. It was a good fit. And while I was at NASA, the whole world had changed from a military perspective. The Gulf Wars had happened, and we were about to embark on the Iraqi War. And what was being asked of our young people in uniform was completely different than my experience with the Cold War and the types of things we concentrated on. Deployments are the norm for our young people today in uniform. And that was a completely different arrangement than where I had left things in 1990, which, by the way, was before the fall of the Soviet Union when I went to NASA. So I tried to relate. I came back and I said, you know, I lived on space station for 6 months. That's a deployment. You know, I think there's an opportunity here to contrast and compare. You young people, you're going over to the sandbox 6 months at a time, and I went to space station for 6 months, and I think there's a lot of commonality here. There's a strong sense of mission. When you go deploy, you stay mission-focused, and you really don't have to worry about much else because it's all about the mission. You've got things you got to get done. You have no distractions to speak of, and it's easy to put all your focus on doing what's necessary to make your mission successful. Also, it's a hardship for family and friends. You go to space station, you're away from your family and friends. You go to the sandbox, you're away from family and friends. You miss anniversaries and birthdays. You miss the kids' plays. You miss a lot of things. And you hear about them, but it's not the same as being there. And it's really hard to tell your kids that. Also, a sense of risk. You know, flying in space is not the 1,000% complete safe thing to do. It's pretty well managed from a risk standpoint, but it's not completely safe, and neither is going to the sandbox, obviously. There's conflict over there. It's warfare. So there's a sense of risk we both shared, right? And then I realized this is the biggest lesson of all. We were doing the same things, but there was one big, big difference. Our young people in the military do not sign up voluntarily to go do what they do with these hardships, separation from family, because they get a trip to space. They do it because they have a sense of duty to our country. They have an amazing commitment, and they want to keep our freedoms free. And so while it's completely understandable that people look at astronauts as heroes, it's our young people in uniform today that are my heroes. Thank you very much.
If we tried to give Susan all the questions that come in, we'd be here till 2 o'clock at the earliest. You're very kind in all the questions that we brought forward. Before I do go to questions, Shelley asked me to do one thing that she would normally do. We want to present you with two books, Marco Island and Naples. The Marco Island book is from one of our members who contributes them every year for our speakers.
Take that
home with you. And here's the book on Naples for you, okay? I will put them back. Oh, there we go. Thanks, Shelley. Okay, first question. As you know, we had General Chilton here a couple years ago, who also was an astronaut. Let's tell the audience how what he did as an astronaut differs from what you've done as an astronaut, okay?
I know Chilly Chilton very well, by the way. He was also in the astronaut band. He was our rhythm guitar player. So we spent a lot of nights in rehearsals together. trying to prove people we had talent beyond just doing our day job, which we weren't very successful at, but it was a lot of fun. A lot of astronauts, by the way, are musicians. I don't know. There must be something about the math of music that we find attractive. But in any case, Chile had, he and I were in the space shuttle program a lot of the same time. He was selected in 1987. I was selected in 1990. And he had a chance to fly on the space shuttle three times and even was the commander of the space shuttle as well. But like I said early on in my comments, the space shuttle is a short-term mission. It only had the resources to fly in space like an airplane, if you will. I know a lot of you know it looks kind of like an airplane, but it flies in space 1 to 3 weeks. And as I said, because it had a sense of a short-term adventure, and because mission control talks to you constantly, and because it's a very, very tightly scheduled business trip of a sort, business is probably not the right word, but you get a sense that it is not normal life. It is a short time you have to be very efficient at accomplishing. His experiences on flying the shuttle and my experience of flying on the space station were very, very different, because the space station, as I mentioned, is a space outpost. It's like a permanent location that is not on Earth. And psychologically, that is a different experience. I would tell you that it did feel like a much grander adventure to live on a space outpost than to fly on the space shuttle. And I know many of you here in this room would take any space flight you could get, no matter how short. But it helped me realize that there is a grand strategy. The baby steps of the Gemini and Apollo era, the little walking steps of the shuttle going up and coming down again a couple weeks later, and now we have this space outpost which has permanent human-tended presence for the last 15 or so years, which I had the opportunity to be a part of. And the next step, of course, is going beyond orbit to somewhere else. And we've done that with the moon, but again, that was a one-week trip. And so he had the opportunity for the shuttle toddler steps, and I had the opportunity to go into the teenage years with the space station. But in the grand strategy, the younger people who are out there today will get that experience to try the trip to Mars, which is intended at some point to be also permanently tended, hopefully, by humanity and not by aliens. So...
Here's a question from a student. How did your days and nights pass in space?
How did our days and nights pass in space? We had, I'm going to talk about the space station because I think that is the most interesting. We had two mission controls that we talked to all the time when they talked, and there was a lot of dead space when they didn't talk because of communication links. But we talked to Houston, Mission Control Houston, and we talked to Mission Control Moscow. Obviously, we talked to Houston in English, and we talked to Moscow in Russian. So all the astronauts and cosmonauts needed to learn both languages. And so the question is, well, which clock do you live by? Do you live by Moscow clock, or do you live by Houston clock? You know, and these are, I think, if I recall, about 8-9 hours apart, depending on daylight savings time. And there was a huddle and an agreement that we would live by Greenwich time, which is 3 hours off of Moscow and 6 hours off of Houston, I think. So 5 or 6 hours off of Houston. So we lived by the clock, and you have to live by the clock because you cannot live by the sunrise and sunset. You orbit the Earth every 90 minutes or so, which means that you see a sunrise every 45 minutes, and then you see a sunset every 45 minutes, and then a sunrise. And so you couldn't sleep by the sun. You had to sleep by the clock. And so we would wake up 6 a.m. Greenwich time, and we would go to bed at 10 o'clock at night, Greenwich time. And then all during the day, we would have task lists, assignments every morning, not by the sun, but by the clock. Every morning we would get an uplink with all of our daily tasks and some previews of the week, of what we could expect over the next week. And the tasks were as varied as you can imagine for your day-to-day life on Earth. There were just three of us. And the three of us constituted a microcosm of society. There had to be someone that was a medical doctor. There had to be someone who understood photography. We had to have robotics, spacewalks, maintenance. understanding how to maintain the thermal control system, understanding how to fix the treadmill when it broke. So we had a whole bunch of tasks, and the three of us basically became a micro-society. And my particular specialties were the computers, the medicine, and the inventory management, which is one of the key things about space that you have to understand, which is, where is your stuff? If your stuff breaks loose of its Velcro on a place like Space Station, good luck finding that, because the air currents will carry it somewhere, and one of the astronauts' biggest fears was to lose something and not be able to find it, a critical tool or your eating fork or what have you. These were things that mattered up in an environment like that that probably aren't as much of a problem here on Earth.
Okay, next question. What is the future of the U.S. space programs, and what would it be and why if you got to make the decision?
I did allude a little bit to the future, which is certainly from NASA's perspective. I no longer work for NASA now, but clearly exploration is their charter. And so right now, they're moving toward that. They're moving toward building the larger rockets. They're moving toward new and improved crew capsules. They're looking at what's being built today to see how it could apply tomorrow to go beyond the space station's orbit. I think the obvious options are the moon, going back to the moon and learning how to live there, perhaps on a more permanent basis. And then, of course, the real obvious one is, if you're going to go visit another planet, you've got to go to Mars. Mars is, you don't want to go to Venus. You'll melt if you go to Venus, or your spacecraft will melt. So we need to go to Mars, which actually, in the big scheme of things, is a fairly friendly planet environmentally. It's got gravity. It's got temperatures we can probably build hardware to withstand. It doesn't have the air we need to survive and breathe, but we are learning a lot about life support systems on the space station that will be applicable to a Mars outpost. And yes, it's a long ways away, but it's doable. It's not decades. It's not generations. It's months. So Mars is the obvious one to me. We are talking about landing on an asteroid. I think the administration has talked about landing on an asteroid. You did ask about my personal preference. My preference, and this is just Susan Helms, is I'd go to a moon base first, learn how to do it right in a dusty environment with low gravity, and then I would take the lessons learned from the moon base experience and use that and apply it to a longer-term trip to Mars. That's what Susan Helms would do if she was able to make these decisions.
Okay, a couple, there are probably half a dozen, 10 questions about two movies, Gravity and The Martian. And most people want to know whether your spacesuit was like what Sandra Bullock wears, or The Martian. What happened when the commander left the space capsule?
Well, I've seen both movies. I saw Gravity when it came out in the theater. I was the commander out at Vandenberg Air Force Base, and my troops begged me to take them to the movie. So I did go to the movie with several of my colonels and sat there. They were watching my face instead of the movie, I think, while I was seeing it. But I will tell you, Sandra Bullock's spacesuits were 100% what I experienced as far as what she wore as spacesuits. It's when she took off the spacesuits that things were different. We did not have that designer underwear that she had on when she took off her spacesuit. We wear something considerably less sexy and more robust. And so that was when I was admiring the detail, the attention to detail on the spacesuits themselves, the Soyuz capsules, the way the space station looked inside. I was very impressed with the cinematography. I think it actually won an Academy Award for cinematography, and deservedly so. But then there were these little details that I think they changed in the interest of entertainment, including what she had on under her spacesuit. It was considerably different than what I had been experiencing. I saw the movie The Martian just this week, this past week, like less than a week ago. And everything that happened with the crew to me seemed believable from the standpoint of lack of life support systems. I can see this scenario. We have trained for some of these scenarios in the NASA shuttle program and the station program. you know, we do have a prime directive, never leave anyone behind from the standpoint of abandoning ship of a space station. But I think the scenario they painted in that movie, it was the Kobayashi Maru, for those of you who are familiar with Star Trek terminology, and I did not have any problem with how they played that out, because it was either lose one or lose all. And I think the commander, I liked the part where they left, the commander ended up making that decision, because that is what commanders do. They're hired, trained to make tough calls. And no one second-guessing that call, I think, was also something I was happy to see play out in the movie. Because commanders have a very, very tough life from the standpoint of the choices that have to be made. And they're not paid enough to make those choices in a lot of cases. So positively impressed with The Martian also from that viewpoint.
Quick question. Were you able to see the Great Wall of China from space?
His question was, were you able to see the Great Wall of China from space? I get asked this question actually quite a bit. I imagined I could. We looked for it. Yuri had a lot of experience flying on space stations before our mission together, and Yuri and Jim and I remember having a discussion of making a point of trying to see the Great Wall of China. And I think what I really saw was a little bit of a disconnect between two lines on Earth that Yuri pointed at and said, that's where the Great Wall of China is. So I think I looked down on the part of Earth where it was, but I cannot tell you that I saw it. But I do think it is seeable if you know what you're looking for and how to find it. Stuff, there's a lot of stuff on Earth that makes it difficult to pick out specific features. I also imagined I saw the top of the Luxor in Las Vegas. For those of you, I'm familiar with Las Vegas for reasons I won't go into, but the bottom line is I wanted to see if I could see that little light that points out of the top of that pyramid, that casino in Las Vegas, and I imagine that I did. Whether I did or not is another question.
As you went around the world looking down on Earth, could you see the circles from center pivot irrigation, both American and nationally, internationally?
I absolutely could see. He's talking about the irrigation crop circles. And yes, you can see those actually quite distinctively, and where you really see them is in places of the world where there is vast desert. You can see different, and this is where you do see a difference of countries. You can see one country that is working hard at their irrigation, and that's where you see an arrangement of these little teeny tiny green circles on top of what looks like a vast sand pit. And then not too far away from that, the vast sand pit is still there, and then you realize there's another country that owns that sand that is not as invested in trying to do irrigation and crop development, even though it's all the same earth. It's a choice of countries whether or not they put time and money into that kind of infrastructure. But that's one that pops out at you when you're flying over, say, for example, Saudi Arabia. You can see those little teeny tiny crop circles of that those irrigation systems. And they always seem to be circular. Why is that?
It's a center pivot.
So, and I heard we have someone here that builds this kind of equipment? No?
No, we have a company in a country that 50% of their business goes internationally.
Okay. Well,
all right, one last question. If you had not ended up at the academy, if you had not gone in the Air Force and become an astronaut, was there any other kind of profession you thought about pursuing?
Well,
other than a jazz pianist.
So his question was the alternate universe, I think, of where I would be if I hadn't taken the path that I took. I do think I still would have joined the Air Force. My father was, as you know, an Air Force pilot. We thought of ourselves as an Air Force family, so even if I hadn't gone into the academy, I still would have gone to ROTC at Oregon State. That was my second choice. So I still would have become an Air Force officer. I'm positive of that. I still would have become an engineer because I made that choice when I was in eighth grade, which I understand is really bizarre to make that choice when you're in eighth grade. And so I would have ended up on some sort of military adventure somewhere, somehow, as an engineer, doing what I did. And I dare say, at least in the first several years, I would have had a very common experience with where I ended up.
Susan Helms, thank you for coming here today, and thank you for what you have done to help preserve peace in our country.
Thank you.
Outstanding, okay? Outstanding. Thank you.